Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm glad you could join us today. We're going to do something special. Every year we put on a festival, the New Yorker Festival, a whole weekend blowout of interviews, panels, performances, screenings. It's a who's who of the people who are making news and shaping the worlds of culture, politics, journalism, food, you name it. And we're going to be bringing you the highlights of it here on the Radio Hour throughout the year. Staff writer Alexis Akeowo spoke with the multi-talented British artist Riz Ahmed. Ahmed won an Emmy for his performance in HBO's The Night Of. He also appeared last year in Star Wars Rogue One, and he's known as a rapper, an activist.
And as W Magazine put it recently, the internet's boyfriend.
Wait, just hold up a minute, Wait, backstage you promised that this wouldn't happen. We were like, should we come out together or do you want to come out afterwards? And I said, if I'm going to awkwardly sit through you bigging me up, then we ain't coming out together.
I may have lied.
So you stabbed me in the back, just off the jump. Thank you, good. Trust. Yeah.
So, Riz, you grew up in London. What are your strongest memories of growing up there? I read that one of your first memories was going to Pakistan at the age of 2 to be circumcised, and your family made a song and dance about it.
She's so nice backstage. And you come out, it's the New Yorker journalist, and the fans come out. I told you that privately. Yeah, man, that's my first memory, Dr. Kareem. Dr. Kareem, he had a very powerful mustache. And yeah, it was a recurring joke, weirdly. It was my first private joke with my parents was like, we'll beat up Dr. Kareem with a hockey stick because of what he did to you. And like only years later, I realized, way to pass the buck. Like they went and sought out Dr. Kareem to do that to me.
What were you like as a kid?
I was very kind of hyperactive kid.
Mm-hmm. And what was your family like? Your parents moved to the UK from Pakistan in the 70s.
Well, I guess I should talk a little bit about that. You know, migration has kind of been a part of my family's ancestry and history for a very long time, actually, and as it has for all of ours. But I'm from an ethnic group called Muhajirs. Mm-hmm. So Muhajir means North Indian Urdu-speaking Muslim that has now moved to Pakistan post the partition of India and Pakistan, which happened under the British in 1947. So ancestrally for hundreds of years, my family is North Indian from UP. And what Muhajir means is refugee. So you've got different ethnic groups in Pakistan. You've got Baloch, you've got Sindhis, you've got Pathans, you've got Punjabis, and you've got, we're not gonna do it for every ethnic group. It's South Asia's complex. It's gonna be here all night. And then you've got refugees as like their own ethnic group, which is kind of weird. And I only really realized in recent years, it's like, that's like my identity is, you know, someone who leaves home to go somewhere else. And that kind of fluidity of identity is something that I had to contend with a lot growing up as a kid. Yeah. It's something that's kind of probably why I ended up acting. And it's something that I'm very much, you know, I think about, spend a lot of time thinking about whatever medium I'm trying to create in today. So I think that was a lot of kind of growing up, that and, you know, Thundercats, like everyone else.
Right. And WWF wrestling.
WWF,
right?
Macho Man Randy Savage is my man, yeah.
So did you always want to perform? Because, I mean, we were talking about how growing up in the 90s, the UK was kind of the cultural center of the South Asian diaspora. There was a lot of art making, storytelling, a lot of voices doing interesting things in music and literature at the time you were growing up.
Yeah, it was interesting because we went from being kind of completely invisible in the culture to all of a sudden when I hit my teenage years, there was this moment, not dissimilar to the kind of, you know, brown cultural moment that's taking place in the US right now as a kind of response to a lot of this, you know, xenophobia and Islamophobia that's going on. This kind of didn't grow out so much out of a direct kind of political moment or political backlash. But it was just really about a generation coming of age. My parents' generation saw themselves as guests in the country. Mm. For me and my generation, obviously, as for many people here that are kind of third culture kids, it's like, well, this is my country. I'm entitled to be here. So there was a kind of self-confidence to British Asian culture that kind of started taking root in the 90s. And you saw this amazing moment where, I don't know if anyone's familiar with a sitcom. It was kind of like a brown Key and Peele show called Goodness Gracious Me. You don't know that? So BBC. Wow. this is so different to a rap show. People shout out BBC. And so basically, yeah, you had this kind of moment where you had this brown sketch show that was huge and everyone was watching it, and you had Nitin Sawhney kind of coming to prominence as a kind of composer and musician. Talvin Singh won the coveted Mercury Music Prize. There was this kind of East London drum and bass, you know, Brit-Asian music scene that was coming out of East London. So it was this moment of like, all right, we've arrived, we're doing this thing.
Right.
We're going to make this new thing. But it didn't quite pan out like that.
So you went to drama school. You left a little bit early to take your first role in The Road to Guantanamo, which is a docudrama based on a true story, based on three British Muslim friends who mistakenly ended up in Guantanamo.
Put him in cell 11.
Were you a member of Al-Qaeda?
Al-Qaeda ke rukn the?
Nahi.
How long were you in Afghanistan?
Afghanistan mein kitni der tak?
You know, I can speak English, yeah. I'm British.
You speak English, you don't need a translator.
I'm British.
Are you an observant Muslim? Are you a good Muslim?
I try to be.
After one of the first screenings, you, some of the actors and some of the subjects the film was based on were detained in a UK airport. You were interrogated about your politics. And unfortunately became the first of a series of encounters you would have with British immigration, being detained, being questioned about your motives and what you're doing. I mean, what was that like? Because I later want to go into the fact that that inspired some of your music.
Yeah, it was a life-changing experience, that job, because I was coming to the end of my time at drama school and I was thinking, what the hell am I doing? You know, there's a lot of crazy stuff happening in the world right now. I feel passionately engaged in it. I want to kind of comment on it or just engage with it. And as an actor, I'm going to be playing cab driver number two. How does that work? How do those two things work? And out of the blue, I just got this phone call. Michael Winterbottom, the kind of prolific filmmaker from the UK, his casting director saw a photograph of me on the drama school website. Mm. And I got this job and I was like, oh my God, it's an opportunity to square these two things that I love. Yeah. And do them both. Yeah. And I did that film. It was vindication for their experience. It won an award at Berlin Film Festival. Went to Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, you know, Axis of Evil World Tour. And then came and like landed back at Luton Airport. And remember, just got taken to one side, got taken into an unmarked room. And before you know it, British, you know, ironically named intelligence officers were kind of like putting me in arm locks and wrist locks and kind of like shouting in my face, going, did you become an actor to further the Muslim struggle?
Right.
It's like, no, I became an actor to get girls, but it didn't really work out. Instead, I'm in this f***ing room with you, you know? And like, oh, what do you think of the Iraq war? And, you know, all this stuff, and the whole thing was crazy and it was just intense. And I came out of that experience, and then some of the other boys, the Tipton Three themselves, the ex-Guantanamo detainees, were sat there, and I was like, outraged, and I remember they just went, yeah, I know, man, it happens all the time. Mm. Happens to us all the time. Just go get breakfast. And I was just like, wow, this is crazy. So we just leaked it to a couple of journalists, but it inspired me to write a song.
Yeah.
Which is called the Post 9/11 Blues.
This is the Post 9/11 Blues.
What can I yes, do? The Post 9/11 Blues, which was basically banned from radio and TV play.
Yeah, I mean, this was something that kind of, for me, was very much a personal song.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it kind of was a comment on everything that was going on socially and politically at that time. This was April 2006, just a year after the 7/7 bombings.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it was kind of a very tongue-in-cheek, you know, lyrics like, you know, we're all suspects, so watch your back. I farted and got arrested for a chemical attack.
Right.
You know, kind of thing. It's Shakespeare. is what I'm trying to say. My friends go, Riz is still one of us. But if I haven't shaved, they won't sit with me on the bus. Everybody do the post 9/11 dance. Look scared, shake your ass when the bombs go. I believe to this day that the idea of like art that's political and art that's not political is a fallacy. It's a dangerous fallacy, I think.
Exactly.
Because all politics is a point of view on the world. And all that any piece of art is a point of view on the world. Any kind of voice or perspective that is traditionally marginalized or goes unheard is just labeled political because you're not used to it being articulated, so it's somehow subversive and goes against the status quo. Mm. And I just think, so the idea of political art, I think, is
exactly. So what were those early editions like? I mean, you've talked about code switching and also about, you know, a really great way of saying it, that there's three stages for a minority actor. One, where you're playing the stereotypes. Two, where you're perhaps subverting the stereotypes. And three, where you're playing a role that has nothing to do with your race or religion. That's just, you're playing a guy named Bob. So what was it like navigating, realizing those categories as you're going on those early editions and code switching? And
yeah, I mean, I guess I came into, I started my career as an actor just as like that stage two was taking place when it was, you know, you've got the stereotypes and you've got the stories that are taking place in ethnicized terrain, but very much kind of trying to overturn those stereotypes, such as Road to Guantanamo, or like a song like Post 9/11 Blues, or yeah, a film I did called Four Lions, is very much jumping on that bandwagon, but to try and overturn it or redirect it to somewhere with more nuance. And that's when I kind of started. But then that third stage of like playing someone who's like just a guy, mm-hmm, I feel like I really misarticulated that when I was talking about that analogy, because okay, that third stage isn't necessarily someone who's just called Bob. Mm. Could also be someone called Nas.
Okay.
It could also be someone called Rizwan. Mm-hmm. It's just about, you know, the cultural specificity or the kind of ethnicity of that character isn't front and center in a way that is about like that's turned into an issue. Mm-hmm. So I think the Holy Grail is very specific work, but it somehow is unshackled from like the capital M minority kind of
right,
issue-laden portrayal, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, not long after that, you started filming the incredible, devastating HBO series, The Night Of, something you called an endurance test, both physically and emotionally. It's a story of a young Pakistani-American man from Queens named Nas, who's unjustly accused of murder and his resulting odyssey into the American criminal justice system.
I sit there every day. I watch you fight for me. I think, why is she doing this? I mean, it's not for the money, because you're not getting paid, I'm sure. At least not much.
It's my job. And it's your right.
Is that all?
And what I love about that scene is that it feels like you're doing so many things at once. You're being vulnerable, but then also possibly manipulative, possibly seductive. And it becomes harder to read the character as the series progresses. As an actor of South Asian descent, you know, you're often asked to talk about diversity. You're often asked to talk about representation. But there's a difference, right, between representation and diversity. And what are the pitfalls of...
Well, it's interesting because there's pitfalls to both those, right?
Right.
Diversity is like this idea of, you know, you've got your burger, and then you've got the optional extra on the sides, you've got the fries, and that's diversity. If you're one of the only South Asian or African American or Latino or gay or trans portrayals on screen at a given moment or in writing at a given moment, you carry a gigantic burden
completely
on your shoulders to try and kind of represent this incredibly diverse experience.
Exactly.
And so diversity gives you that get out. It's like, no, it's diverse, you know, but
right,
representation is like you're punching through, but with all this stuff you're carrying on your back.
Yeah. I want to talk a bit about your music career as Riz MC. You know, a lot of people obviously have seen you on the Hamilton mixtape talking truthfully about how immigrants get it done or get the job done. But I mean, you had a long career before that.
You know, the best thing about the Hamilton mixtape wasn't that for me they was like top the charts and all this stuff. It was like my godson and goddaughter, every time they now like tidy their room or like pull the flush on the toilet, they say, "Immigrants, we get the job done."
Amazing.
And that's great because, you know, you're reframing immigrants as
exactly
synonymous with superhero.
Right.
Which is a good thing. In terms of my influences, I mean, I don't know how many of you would be familiar with the kind of UK underground dance music culture, but it's something that I'm, one of the things I think we're proudest of in the UK, so a kind of, the kind of culmination of that, this journey since the kind of mid-80s to today, I guess, is going from jungle to drum and bass to garage to grime to dubstep and then back to this kind of grime revival is, I think, uniquely UK in that it could only exist in a city as multicultural as London.
Yeah.
And so that was really the cocktail I grew up on, alongside, I guess, you know, US rap. I mean, kind of, you know, that was definitely a big kind of template for us.
Right. Would you like to do a piece for us?
So many of you will have heard this before, but I make a point to always perform it because when I first wrote this, I didn't perform it for about three and a half years because I was worried what people would think about it. And so I perform it a lot because it reminds me to try and not think about that. So it's called Sour Times. I wrote this when we were doing The Road to Guantanamo. In these sour times, please allow me to vouch for mine. Bitter taste in my mouth, spit it out with a rhyme. Ayo, I'm losing my religion to tomorrow's headlines. Guantanamo, sorry bro? Nah, nothing, it's fine. And now it's post 7-7. Why are they calling it that? They're trying to link it to New York like we're all under attack from the same big bad guy, but it's taking a because the truth is, terrorism isn't what you think it is. There ain't no supervillain planning these attacks from some base. The truth is so much scarier and harder to face. See, there's thousands of angry young men that are lost, sidelined in the economy, a marginal cost. They think there's no point in putting ballots up in the box. They got no place in the system and no faith in its cogs. They're easy targets to be getting brainwashed by these knobs who say that spilling innocent blood is pleasing a god. Well, it sounds good when you don't see no justice or jobs. The gas bills are piling up, but all the oil's getting robbed. So David's taken out Goliath and his wife and his dog, segregated, castrated. Now we see who's on top. So see, it ain't religious faith that's causing these crimes. It's losing faith in democratic free market designs. It's no coincidence the bombers came from ghettos up north and the way that Bush and Blair talked gave a lost boy a cause. Then double standards get them angered both at home and abroad. There's a monopoly on pains, that's why they forge their own swords. The misguided turn violent, strap themselves up with bombs. But they're still cowards. Because they ain't here when the backlash is on. So in these sour times, please allow me to vouch for mine. Bitter taste in my mouth, spit it out with a rhyme. Ayo, I'm losing my religion to tomorrow's headlines. Abu Ghraib, sorry mate? Nah, nothing, it's fine. So, all the mans that want to say that my religion has to change, that we're stuck in the bygone age, it's time to set the vinyl straight. Don't you think it's kind of strange that all this terror outrage, these last gasp castaways, these bastards that will blast away, turned up in the last decade when Islam has been the way for millions from back in the day? Instead of thinking that we're crazy, investigate just what it says. Fast, help the poor and pray. Go Mecca, be steadfast in faith. That's the basics, that's the base. So how did we get here today? Well, interpretations always change. Today they're red with rage. Binge hardened up. Desperation's kind of makes you use a book of peace as weapons in a ruck. So listen. Terrorism isn't caused by religion or an old school vision of Islam. It's against the Quran and it's a new innovation caused by mashup situations. That's what makes them turn to arms. The problem is modern and it's all local factors. Dictatorships, injustices, and wars cause fatwas. So in these sour times, please allow me to vouch for mine. Bitter taste in my mouth, spit it out with a rhyme. Hey, I'm losing my religion to tomorrow's headlines. But it's fine.
Well, Rich, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. And I want to thank you all for coming. This is wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you very much, guys. Thank you.
Riz Ahmed speaking with staff writer Alexis Akewo at the New Yorker Festival earlier this month. And that wraps it up for today. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm David Remnick. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with special help from the staff of the New Yorker Festival, Rhonda Sherman, Alexis Goldberg, David Ohana, Bradley G., and Hillary Leichter-Griffin. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.